Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. Your hosts are Dr. On, board-certified clinical sexologist, and Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. Xander will do us the honors in introducing our guests.
Thank you, On. Yes, our guest today is Dr. Karen Whitmire. Dr. Whitmire is a mental health therapist and a sex therapist who works with LGBTQIA clients and those in non-traditional relationship structures. Dr. Whitmire is actually a returning guest. She's back on to talk, not exclusively, but we're going to talk about this to start off. She recently completed her dissertation on the topic of new relationship energy in non-monogamous relationships. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Whitmire.
Thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. For ease, can I call you Karen from now on?
Absolutely.
Okay. I recall that we touched on this topic of new relationship energy and non-monogamous relationships during your last interview. Now you have completed your dissertation. You've been awarded your doctorate degree. And so we wanted to find out, what did you find out through your research? Then we'll see where else we go from there.
Yeah, and maybe I should have brought up a few more notes, but I can give you the gist of it. What I was looking at is how your attachment system can react to this disruption. Oftentimes when people are opening up their relationship or early in the non-monogamy journey, they're not expecting this new relationship energy part. They haven't really heard a lot about it. There's not a lot out there in the literature about it, but it can hit some people, not everyone, really hard, and it's unexpected, and it can really disrupt any established relationships. So you've got two people in an established relationship. One of them goes out, gets into a new relationship. They experience this in a very big way. And it's a lot of oxytocin. It's a lot of dopamine hitting you all at once. And it literally changes the way that you behave. And so that can cause disruption in the established relationship. I was really looking at that period of time where this disruption is happening, how people are going back and forth. There's this action-reaction thing going on. And I really wanted to get into some of the details with that because I've just noticed there are a lot of therapists out there that really don't understand this. The monogamy world, when they look at limerence, is what it was originally coined as. It was treated as a bit of an anomaly. You go through this once or twice. You go through it when you're young, and then it's done with. You're in a relationship. But in non-monogamy, you're going through it over and over and over again, though the more you go through it, the more you get used to it, the more you its effects. It doesn't cause as much disruption. I wanted to look at these disruptions, key themes associated with the disruptions, and really have a better understanding of ways you can apply interventions in couple therapy or even individual therapy to help even therapists understand what's going on during this time, because it can be really confusing for a lot of people. And I'm continually surprised at how much it comes up in my own therapy practice.
That's really interesting because it makes sense when you're in the early stages of a relationship. I think we know that. People call it falling in love, or there's different ways that we talk about it. It surprises me that people wouldn't assume that when they opened up their relationship and there was a new person entering, that they wouldn't have that experience again. It's shocking to me that people wouldn't think that. And I could see how it could be disconcerting, or you use the word disrupting, of a relationship, but I could also see how it could create maybe jealousies, resentments, animosities, because that newness in a lot of relationships, that newness does fly it down a bit. And so the person's like, you don't have that kind of energy with me anymore. Why not? Because they don't really understand that we can't live in a sustained high energy level. And so that's my first thing. The second is, that seems like not a really good place to be on a continuous basis, because that's a lot of hormones and a lot of energy and a lot of lack of sleep and a lot of redirection. And so I just wonder, are there people who might be, instead of bungee jumping, they're jumping into new relationships constantly? Is there a component to this there?
There is. It wasn't something I studied this time, but it definitely came up. We talk in the non-monogamy community about this in our re-addiction. You get in, and you see this in monogamy as well. Love addiction is usually what they call it, where you get into a relationship, you have the high for 60 days to 2 years, usually less than 2 years, because the bigger the high, the more these relationships tend to crash and burn as well. And then when that relationship crashes and burns, you're immediately going out and trying to find a new person to fill in the hole now that you're depressed from the burn. So it can really wear you out, but for people who are more prone to addictive behaviors, I think this becomes something that you can go and chase. And obviously, that becomes a problem if you're trying to also maintain established relationships and you're constantly going through this cycle. It can get really weary on the existing relationship.
You find, Karen, that happens quite a bit in your practice when you say you hear a lot of these cases. Do you find that the interaction between couples isn't always honest? Does that tend to get in the way?
Yeah, one of the things that I see quite commonly is that one person will have been asking for an open relationship for many, many years, and the other person has resisted them. And then the other person finally finds someone that they decide they really like, so they ask to have the open relationship. And a surprising number of times, that person ends up just leaving the established relationship for the new relationship, not even realizing that what they're experiencing is this NRE phase that doesn't actually mean this person is your new soulmate or anything like that. It's just a biochemical reaction that is tricking you into having basically more babies or readjust your schedule to a new person. I see it happen, and even when I tell people that this is probably what's going on and you need to maybe do some insight or slow things down a little bit, which has its own set of meanings that is different for everyone, the NRE gives you such rose-colored glasses that you just don't accept this. And it feels so good and so connecting that you're like, no, this obviously means something if it feels this way, but it doesn't, and you're just telling yourself things. One of the reasons that it gets better as you go through the process more and more and more is because you learn to recognize where your rose-colored glasses sit, and you're better capable of looking at things, understanding that that's the lens through which you're seeing them through, having more realistic expectations about it. And it does put a little bit of a damper on the high, but not that much. And then just with age, I think we all lose our ability to access the level of oxytocin and dopamine. I don't have any scientific research on that, but I certainly see it happening a lot less into the people's 40s, 50s, 60s. Though one of the people on my dissertation committee was in his 90s, and he would talk about how he would still fall into NRE with people. And I just thought that was amazing. It gave me hope. It feels good, right, to be in it. You just got to be cautious with it too.
The word that I kept hearing in my head as you were talking is intoxicating,
Absolutely.
which, of course, we use that word when we're talking about love, but we recognize that it's also a word that is reminiscent to alcohol and drugs and that intoxicating feeling, because it is hormones in our body, biochemicals that are like opioids or amphetamines, and it's giving us all these really great feelings. You use the word high, giving us that high. I know that you focused on the, it's not right in front of me, so I'll try it. I think you said LGBTQIA. I'd really be interested to know how NRE shows up for intersex people. I think that's interesting. So basically, non-heterosexual relationships, is there a difference? Right? Is NRE showing up differently in non-heterosexual relationships? And why do you think that might be?
Yeah, so I put in a lot of effort in my research to make sure I was not just interviewing cishet people. Most of my people who participated, my research participants, were queer in some way, several lesbians, several people who were transgender, plenty of non-white people. Since everyone does research on white cishet people, I wanted to make sure that there were very few of those in my research study. And both the lesbians and the people who are transgender mentioned seeing this huge burst of NRE within their community. One of them mentioned that they think, especially within the transgender community, you have the same background. You have the same sense of being alienated from the people around you in the wider community. And so this feeling of connection and increased communication that happens when you're in NRE just gets really amplified. You really start to identify with each other through this lens of feeling like I've been oppressed, I feel like I've been cut off from the rest of the world, and here I have community, even if it's in the smaller community, here it is, and this is fantastic, and it feels good without really recognizing whether or not that means you're actually compatible as a couple long term. It's got all those feel good, you feel like my soulmate connections associated with it. I don't know if that makes sense for either of you.
Yeah, I think it goes back to that dopamine release. We're always chasing dopamine, that chemical, that wonderful chemical that can get us into trouble.
And the oxytocin of feeling connected, right? And
Yes.
you can feel that in
Yeah.
your community. This also wasn't exactly in the research, but heard people talk about developing a form of NRE with new friends, new jobs, your car, anything that's new to you. You can get into this rose-colored glasses state until reality eventually kicks in. I was taking 100 pictures of my dog when I got my dog, and now I'm like, eh, she's adorable, right?
I wonder what the time period is for individuals who may have those peaks and troughs, but then eventually plateau out. You mentioned a duration of time. Can you repeat that? I find that absolutely fascinating because I wonder if that is generational or is it just across the board among all generations?
So when they were doing the research on passionate love in the early 80s, they were looking at time durations of 0 to 18 months. And it depends on how fiery it can get. And upwards of 2 years within the non-monogamy community, the standard convention is don't make any big decisions about your relationships for 2 years because this can blindside you. And I think really what you get is this peak in the 2 to 3 month range, and then it very slowly drops off after that. But it does tend to take people, especially the younger you are, the less you know about what you want in a relationship. It does take people just that long to get to the place of, oh, this is who you really are as a person. You're not this fantasy I made up of you during the early NRE stage, and you've got your own hopes and dreams over here that might not be compatible with mine or the way that you want to be. And your attachment style. As you come, this is a really interesting thing that's both in the literature and was showing up in my research, is if you're a more avoidant type person, you tend to not trust people as much. Well, all this oxytocin and dopamine makes you trust someone a lot, and you make decisions about how much you want to be with this person based on that trust. And then your distrust kicks back in, and suddenly you're like, who was that that was making those decisions? That's not who I am. And so you'll see even changes in who you want to be to another person with some of these attachment styles. And so the avoidant person had a reduction in anxiety around being in relationships and would get into them a lot quicker and a lot deeper. And people who have a more preoccupied attachment style, it just made them way more anxious. And they really struggled with this push-pull at the beginning of a relationship.
You mentioned briefly about you get in, you have the NRE, this new relationship energy, and then you're not thinking about compatibility at that stage. It made me think of the way people used to talk about love versus lust, that you weren't in love with someone, you were in lust with them because you didn't really want to have a relationship with them, you just wanted to have sex with them. But then you mentioned something about there can be so many different activities or events in our life that can produce a similar energy, like a new fill in the blank energy. Because it made me think of when you see little kids who are meeting each other for the first time and then like run up to each other and hug and kiss, right? And the next time they see each other, they're just like, ah, you know, it's like the best thing that's ever happened to them. And so it's, I would imagine that it's different. I don't know if this has ever been studied, but I would imagine there is a different level maybe of the biochemicals that are being released with new best friend versus new lover versus new job versus new car, but that newness can capture you for a while. Yeah, I've heard people say if you get a certain car, you see them everywhere you go all of a sudden and you never noticed them before. Somehow your visual senses just turned on more to seeing something that you just didn't see before, even though it was there. Right.
Well, I think you're bringing up a really interesting point here around your bonding system and your desire for sex system, I'll call it, are not related, actually. We assume that they're related because both of them are on fire at the beginning of a relationship, but they're really not. I think they did some research a long time ago on when you have very sex segregated communities happening, you'll get this intense bonding that doesn't include a sexuality between members of a community where they're not necessarily attracted to that gender that they're in community with. So You definitely see this. And the same thing, oxytocin is in huge amounts when you have a baby. You're bonding with your child, but that doesn't clearly mean you want to have sex with your child. That's exactly the opposite of what's going on for you. So this oxytocin system is just about the bonding, and we haven't quite figured out exactly what's going on that also increases the sex drive when it comes to mate selection, but it's clearly there. And something else in addition is going on during mate selection that isn't there for all the other types of bonding you might do.
The fact that we're animals and that we have instincts and impulses and desires, and that most of us have a brain that mediates these things, right? We have the prefrontal cortex that mediates these things, most of us, but usually not until our mid to late 20s. And so it makes sense when children and teenagers and young adults are being impulsive and they're in whatever way, sexual, financial, decision making, they're just being impulsive. And I think that people generally understand that, but I have come to find out that not a lot of people understand what the executive functioning is and how it works. The only thing people think about is like, oh, ADHD, right? But they don't really understand. And then all the things about hormones and pheromones. And I remember when I was probably about a year into my transition, I was hearing people say things like the testosterone makes our scent change, the pheromones that we're giving off, and that we're basically attracted to each other because of pheromones. We want to think it's some beautiful, magical thing, but really, we just like each other's stink, that it's unperceptible, really, at the basic level of consciousness. And so I was like, oh, I wonder if my scent is changing, how will that impact my relationship? The attraction, not me to my wife, but my wife to me, I guess, because I was the one that was changing. My smell was changing. A lot of people don't like to be reduced down to we're these animals that give off a scent. And yes, we're not sniffing each other's butts like dogs do, but quite frankly, we would if we could, probably, because we are animals. People don't like to think about it in that way. It seems crude or not very nice or human, right? They want it to be this magical, beautiful thing. I'm talking about this in relation to what you're describing about this new relationship energy and just non-monogamy as a total topic, because I hear a lot of people talking more nowadays than I have most of my life about how monogamy is not natural, or how doing polyamory or non-monogamy or having open relationships, people talk about it different ways, and maybe they all mean different things, that I don't know. That it could be that we have these desires, we have these drives, we have these impulses. And some people just go, yeah, but I'm not going to do anything about it. And other people are just hedonistic and want to run wild with their loins. And so there can be some kind of judgment around that. I know I can be a little judgy. I'm very heterosexual and monogamous and raised Catholic. And so I'm like, I don't know what these people are doing. And it seems very unethical and not very safe and impractical and all these things. How do you give to so many people? I don't know how they do it. I can only handle me and my relationship. Do you hear people talk that way about how people grow up and don't be led by your hormones or your thoughts in your head, those impulses to satiate your desires?
We will be taking our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is Dr. Karen Whitmire, who is discussing new relationship energy in non-monogamous relationships. We are always grateful to our sponsors who support our show. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity. while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is Dr. Karen Whitmire, who is discussing new relationship energy in non-monogamous relationships. Let's get back to our show.
We have these impulses to satiate your desires.
Oh, yeah, I could go a couple of directions on this one. Certainly. First off, I like the phrase infinite diversity and infinite combination a whole lot, because I think it helps you understand, okay, there are people out there that are definitely monogamous and monogamous for life, and they really enjoy it, and great. And there are people out there that are serial monogamous, where they want to be monogamous for 6-7 years or 2 years or whatever, and then move on to the next relationship. And then there are people who are polyamorous, and let's not judge people for where they sit on this. I think it's about whether or not you're doing it and you're paying attention to your behavior, how your behaviors are affecting other people. You're not burning a bunch of bridges impulsively down behind you, and you're going into everything with some level of intention. I think that's really the important part with all of that. And that can be really difficult when you're in your 20s. You just don't know enough about yourself, where you really sit with things. And I certainly get a little frustrated when I see people who are like, yeah, I've been in this monogamous relationship and I fell in love with this new person. Now I must be polyamorous, so I need to open up the relationship. And then they go off with a new person and go be monogamous with them. The average person falls in love twice in their life, goes through this passionate love period twice in their life. And I'm counting it up. I've been through it at least 10 times. Am I this weird outlier? And so it makes you wonder, okay, so maybe most people aren't experiencing this very often. Most people are actually monogamous in their life, and we don't need to pass judgment on who is and who isn't, and just let people be who they're going to be and understand that it might take them 40, 50 years to figure that out sometimes.
Yeah, that would be nice, because I do notice that there can be a tendency. The people that I've known in my life who have been non-monogamous, I think they have perceived that they're being judged. Mm-hmm. And their way to respond to that is to also then judge mm-hmm. others or just reject. And so they'll become part of this quote unquote queer community. And why are they in the queer community? Because the queer community, queer people are destabilizing and deconstructing and destroying and discombobulating everything that they think has made their life more difficult mm-hmm. or systems, structures, people. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like it's a natural drive for them. It's a reactive, it's a reactionary mm-hmm. move that I don't know if it leads to actual satisfaction in doing it. It's like, I'm going to do it because I refuse to be monogamous because monogamy is part of the patriarchy or something like that. But I don't know if they have a natural inclination towards it. You figure it out, but I think maybe there could be some bridge burning along the way.
Yeah. I think you're getting into a great point here. I like to use the term descriptive and prescriptive around labels. And so you see, especially with, for instance, gender essentialists, whether you're cis or trans, a gender essentialist is going to be like, if you're a woman, you have to act absolutely be in the dresses and high femme and all this stuff, where they're, okay, I'm female now. I'm going to now do everything that a female in our society does, whatever that is. And you see that in the poly community. You see that across the board where, like, I'm going to be non-hierarchical poly. I like the way that sounds, and I'm going to go for that regardless of whether or not that's how I actually am, because I need an external label to tell me who I am. And it sounds pretty to me, rather than figuring out what it is you want and who you really are, and then figuring out, okay, is there a label that fits this? It's kind of like this. It's kind of like that. And applying that label as needed. Some people just need something external to hang their identity on a little bit more than others.
Yeah, and I think, Xander, what you were describing was someone defiant, maybe, and defensive. So those double Ds get in the way of being able to move forward and actually operate in a more healthy way. I'm just curious, and I'm throwing this out there. You did this research, and I missed the opportunity to sit in on your dissertation. We learn so much every time we hear someone present their oral defense. Are you planning on doing more research? I don't know if I asked you that before. I don't remember.
I would love to. So I'm volunteering with the American Psychological Association's Division 44, which is the LGBTQIA, but the non-monogamy is a subgroup of this division. And I'm in a mentorship group there. I'm in the literature database group there. So we collect all the research on non-monogamy and collate it into a Zotero database. And I'm hoping to get in on the research committee and start doing more research on this. I want to actually put out a book on this, do more research. I only had 11 subjects in my dissertation because the style of research it was, but I would really love to get this into a book and published. And I've got a billion research ideas that are, I'm going to get two of them done. the energy I have left in my life. Hopefully there will be more research on this. I'm not quite sure how it's going to get done at this point.
You're looking at joining partnerships to be able to make that magic happen and then chasing funding, right?
Yeah. A lot of the research I want to do for the book is probably just going to be on my own free time. So I need to get that going. I took a break after finishing my dissertation to chill out for a little bit, but I want to get the interviewing people pretty soon on that. That's not going to be probably formalized and published in a journal, but I would like to get something published into a journal as well, maybe based on my dissertation.
That's really great.
When you were talking about people might take on an identity or a label, it's not actually going to work for them because I just heard it and it sounded good. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that over the last at least 10 years, I've noticed this in the trans community, that people take on labels or identities because they've scoured the internet and they've read a bunch of things. And then they put together their own unique little matrix label or identity. What you're talking about is similar to, I think you have to live it. Mm. I think you have to do it. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could have come to who I am or how I want to live my life by just looking at social media posts or reading glossaries mm-hmm. or even academic papers. And so I would imagine that it could take some time, like basically a lifetime for some people to really, because you have to expose yourself to a lot of different ideas and a lot of different people. And I think people are exposing themselves to a lot of ideas, but not a lot of people, mm-hmm. right? They're coming to their sense of who they are and what they want and what they like from the internet, but not from actual experience. Is that something that we're nodding yes, which the listener can't see, but I'm not saying something that's completely out in left field, I guess.
No, I think it's interesting. So I work with a lot of clients who are trans and they will wonder, am I really transgender? Because of what I see on the internet is not what I want to be. Well, anything trending favors extremes in some way or another. And you want to pick your way through, figure out who you are through experience. And I think that's by far the better way to go than to look at the internet and decide the extreme thing that's trending is the way to go. And I often say to my non-monogamous clients that when you're coming into this journey, you have no idea what your non-monogamy is going to look like. In the same way that most of us grew up with monogamy and were prescribed a very specific way that monogamy plays out, but we learn through experience that not everyone's monogamy looks the same. And it's the same way in the non-monogamy community, where you arguably have even more options around what your relationship structure looks like. And I've heard consistently from people, it takes me a decade in the non-monogamy community out there experiencing it, dating people, to settle on a style of monogamy that feels really true and authentic to me. And so I see this over and over again. And I think part of that is just because we didn't have books or role models for a very long time in the community. And so it's a little easier to get to that faster because there's more role models out there to look at and be like, maybe not that, maybe that. And I tell everyone coming in, especially if they're trying to open up a relationship, that you got to run science experiments. Set up some agreements, some expectations in the way your non-monogamy is going to look. You're going to run it for a couple of months. We're going to reconvene and decide what's working, what's not working. And don't make these decisions when you're really angry at 3 o'clock in the morning. Give it a couple weeks and then make the decision as you had time to think about it and digest it and process it. But it can take a really long time. I mean, it can take a long time for people to really develop an identity somewhere. And who says you have to settle on anything? Change until you're in your 80s. Who cares? If that works for you and that makes you happy, don't expect that settling on something is the plan for your life. And I do think people try to settle on a thing or head towards a prescriptive label because it does reduce anxiety. The concreteness around that helps you have less anxiety about where you're going.
Our understanding of who we are within a relationship and the years it's taken to build that relationship. And now you enter a new, entirely different world, and that requires adaptation. And then you add in all the different flavors. The sexual orientation may shift. The gender identity may shift. And there are so many aspects to it that it's complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lifetime probably is pretty realistic for most people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though you're working in your particular field with a particular population on a particular subject matter, you're basically doing the same work that I do, which is helping people navigate uncertainty with emotion regulation, distress tolerance, and conflict mitigation.
Yep, absolutely.
It's the same things, because uncertainty is just a fact of life, but it's uncomfortable to not know where we belong and what our name is. What's that label? Because people want to know, what's your this? What's your that? They want to hear these things from you. In other cultures, they ask you about your kids. In our culture, we ask different things of each other. It's so much of the same work. You just happen to be working with a population that a lot of therapists wouldn't know how to work with them and probably wouldn't want to.
Yeah.
But you're doing the bread and butter work of pulse therapy. On, you said something about with all these changes, it could be sexual orientation, it could be gender identity. Well, there's also, what entry point are people coming into this through? Through the kink community, BDSM, swinging, sex clubs, subtle parties, which could be gateway. Where are they coming into it? Have they entered into a relationship with somebody who's already in the scene and they're just learning about it? Or is it a couple that's going out? How do they know where to go? Because maybe they want to be poly or non-monogamous, but they don't want somebody spinning them around on a wheel. But I think sometimes those are the go-tos, I think. Swinging and BDSM. There's not a lot of visible access points. It's like you have to know the secret code when you knock on the door to get in to the community.
I had a student who studied Furbies. She likened it to, we grow up with stuffed animals and we talk to them and they give us a sense of security. And we, as children, we can tell them all our woes and all our celebrations. It led into this whole new community, not new, it's been around for some years, but Furby community, where people dress to their choice. It's a community where everybody relates to one another as Furbies.
Mm.
This was a whole new territory for me.
On, is there a difference between furries and Furbies? Because I haven't heard of Furbies.
Oh God, am I messing it up?
I don't know. There might be. The only reason I'm asking is because I watched a documentary on furries recently, and it started out at those Star Trek conventions, those kinds of things where people were dressing up in the costumes of the animal characters.
Yes.
In the movies. And I had never heard about this. You have a connection and a trust with your stuffed animal. Because I think the furries, if it's the same thing, furry and Furby, it's morphing into something different from what it was originally, which was just fans. It was fans of the animal characters in TV and cartoons and movies.
I'm so glad you questioned that, because Furby was an actual thing. Okay, this was something you bought at the store, something you could order from Amazon. I remember this because my late husband was into a Furby. He liked the Furby opposed to a live animal. He and I didn't see eye to eye on that at all. He had fake fish he would awesome. Feed. Yeah. And he loved his Furby. I messed that up. It is furries. Thank you.
Yeah, I hear people say Furby, but they mean fur babies. Instead of a child, they have a poodle.
I was going to say, I work with a lot of kinky clients, including furries, and I have never heard of Furby in that way. It's
yep. We are on to our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is Dr. Karen Whitmire. Dr. Whitmire discusses new relationship energy in non-monogamous relationships. Stay tuned while we play our sponsor's commercial. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is Dr. Karen Whitmire. Let's get back to our show.
What else should we talk about? What's going on? What do you want to talk about?
You know, we talk about love, right, as this feeling. You were talking about lust versus love. And people think that they're in love when they're in this limerence NRE state. I think this is what messes a lot of people up. We equate that with love. That's what we see in the literature, right? The movies, the TV shows, that must be love because we never see the long-term part of it. And a lot of people think that when they lose this feeling, they're falling out of love with the person. And we've got 1,000 definitions for love. You can, I guess, define it however you want to. If you're relying on love to be an emotion, it's going to come and go like all of your other emotions do. And then how unstable is that going to make your relationship? And I think even bell hooks talked about love being a value. When you switch it over to a value, it's a much more persistent thing. And so if you can look at love as this collection of values, is when I care for someone very deeply and I'm connected to them and I want them in my life, I love them, right? And that can be a friend or a pet or a partner, whatever it needs to be, a child, then you have a set of values by which you treat that person in your life, an intention to continue on the relationship indefinitely into the future. If you consider love to just be this emotion that you have in a way that you feel drawn towards someone, that's just going to come and go with every argument, with everything that you're going through in life. And I think that really does a disservice to real, true love, and then can very much confuse younger people when you're using these terms interchangeably. So I often talk about NRE switching over to this established relationship period, which is a deeper, more committed type of love. And I think it's important that we acknowledge that.
Well, one, we'll acknowledge there are people who were just default monogamous and default non-monogamous. Do you feel there could be people entering into non-monogamy because they've lost that NRE in their primary relationship, or just serial monogamy? Because I think it's probably happening there as well, that they really just want that new relationship energy. They want the NRE. Mm-hmm. I mean, who wouldn't? How nice is that?
Yeah.
But this idea that you mentioned earlier about burning bridges, the pain that that can cause the person that you're in relationship with, and then you ultimately perhaps when that relationship ends, it doesn't seem worth it. How does one know? I don't know where I learned the difference, but it was through life. I mean, I met my wife when I was 39 years old. I don't think if we had met when I was in my 20s, it probably wouldn't have lasted almost 25 years like it has now. Right. So I think I did have to go through a lot of different experiences to really know.
Yeah.
But I think it comes back to that uncertainty, right? It's so uncomfortable to not know.
And it has to take both of you doing it, right? Both of you.
Yeah. You know, there is a unrequited version of it, right? Where it is very one-sided. And this is where you, in extreme versions, you get stalkers who are probably feeling this one-sided, unrequited limerence. Just looking at us, right? I'm a zennial, right? I'm older. I had zero exposure to what limerence was or passionate love or this concept at all when I was in my early 20s. And oh boy, did I feel this a lot, and did it take me for a whole bunch of loops, right? And I made some really stupid decisions in my 20s because of this. And now we've got more internet, we've got the information age. I do see mentions of limerence and ennui a lot more just out there publicly, not as many as I would like to see. But I think we as a culture are starting to understand the impact that this has on our life and our decision-making when we're young. And one of the reasons I want to write the book is if I had had this book in my 20s, I would not have made some really stupid relationship decisions that I made. And I think it is important information. Not everyone even experiences limerence. It's not a universal thing. You can experience it anywhere from like a 0 to 100, where 100 is just extreme and you're making really whack decisions based on the emotions that you're having. One of the key things is it can make you high, but then when you're not in the presence of the other person that you're trying to attach to, you get really depressed. And so it's got these huge swings in emotions that in the wrong setting could be mistaken for bipolar or borderline personality disorder, for instance. Even doctors and mental health therapists are often not very knowledgeable about what's going on with this unless they've taken pointed efforts to study it. And I think whether you're monogamous or non-monogamous, understanding this beginning part of a relationship and how much it can spin you for a loop is incredibly important to people and making better decisions in their 20s, for instance, right? Or even as teenagers, and for people on the outside to be able to look for this thing.
Have you considered public speaking, Karen?
I would love to. I presented at a non-monogamy conference that took place in Rio de Janeiro. I did the online portion. I would love to do a lot more public speaking on this. I just finding the opportunities, there's not a huge number of them. A lot of times when I look at the ASEC conferences or even the WAMF conference, I am not on the marriage and family therapy side, despite what I do. Oftentimes, they're not focusing on these types of problems at those conferences, even though I think it's a very important thing to be happening. So I just also don't feel like there's a lot of room for me to be speaking much more widely about this.
It's such a niche, though.
Yeah, it is.
I would say just go, be the one person. I know I've done that at conferences. Something you said made me think about if a person is experiencing those highs and lows because of just the biochemical reaction to what's going on in them in their relationship, the way our system works a lot here in the United States is you have to have a diagnosis for your insurance to cover for you to get therapy. And so they're going to get diagnosed with anxiety or depression or bipolar or PTSD. But maybe what they're experiencing is just this limerence or new relationship energy and then the crash from it. But they're just having the feelings and the embodied effects of it. And it's going to show up on the measurements as an anxiety or depression or something like that. So they're going to get coded and maybe even medicated in some cases when really they could be helped without any of that. But they'd have to pay out of pocket for it, which is something that a lot of 20-something year olds can't afford, or a lot of people can't afford the whole fee for a therapist.
Yeah, there should be a DSM code for limerence. All right. I think it would be useful. I think more people in our field need to be aware of this happening so that they can look for those signs and then maybe not encourage an anti-anxiety meds. And I'm all for meds, but this is not when you need meds. So maybe some other time, not this time.
We're just about ready to wrap up. Where can people find out more about you and what you're doing? So then when you publish your book, where they can read all about it, please let us know about that.
Yeah. My therapy practice, which I can only see people in Washington State, the therapist, is branchingoutwellbeing.com. And I do have nonmonogamyacademy.com. I used to publish a blog over there before I started my PhD journey. I've got a couple of courses up for free for people who are new to nonmonogamy to take, 6 hours worth of content at least to help you navigate some of the difficulties associated with nonmonogamy.
Do you ever do any coaching? I know a lot of people who are therapists have started doing coaching so they can work with people outside of the state where they're licensed, but they stay in the coaching lane for that. Are you open to that as well?
I do coaching through Non-Monogamy Academy. I've seen a couple of clients that way, and I'm very strict about, like, we are not going to be working on anybody's childhood. We are just helping you get through the opening stages of non-monogamy, usually is what it ends up being, without crashing and burning your entire relationship to the ground.
Wonderful. Yeah, that's good to hear. All right. Anything else? Do you have any sage advice or last word, something you want people to think about or consider?
I mean, just slow down and think about what you're doing and the consequences of it. If I could convince, and I know it can be difficult when you're dealing with anxiety, but just the more you can slow down and act with intention, the better off you're going to be.
Amen. Thank you so much, Dr. Whitmire.
It was good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back.
We hope that you enjoyed this portion of the show with Dr. Whitmire. Until next time, thank you for listening.